got my dice and I got my friends. We're going on a quiz that never ends. You know when there is trouble abound, me and my crew will always be around. Ladies and gentlemen, I am the Lone Gunman, and it's time for the Gamers Haven Podcast with your hosts, Ethan, Jeremy, and Nathan.
Stand by for action.
Gamers Haven Special Edition.
This is Ethan with the Gamers Haven Podcast, and I am sitting down for the first time in quite some time to do an interview with the fine folks over at, I believe, is your company just Lamentations of the Flame Princess, or what is your company name? I'm sorry.
It is indeed Lamentations of the Flame Princess.
I wanted to make sure. All right, and I am here with Mr. I believe it's Zach Smith and Mr. James Raggy the Fourth. Is it Raggy or Raji?
Raggy.
All righty. And I think I got the whole Zach Smith thing correct. That was easy enough.
Yeah.
All righty. Let's go ahead and start off with you, Zach. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got into gaming in general and that sort of thing.
Well, I got into games when I was a kid because I was a little metalhead in the 80s, and that's what you did. And I didn't play for a long time after that. And then a few years ago, my girlfriend was really sick and she was in the hospital and she came home and couldn't really go out for a few months. And so we were looking for things to do that we could do at home. And people who read my blog might know I live in LA. I work in the adult film industry. And so we had some friends there who were like, oh, let's play D&D. And I kind of knew the system. And so we started playing again. And that's where I'm at.
Cool. And what about you, James?
I started gaming when I was 8 or 9 years old. I was already into things like Conan comic books and things like that. And somehow my mother discovered the little metal minis. And she wanted to paint these little metal figurines, but... you know, my guess is, as a single mother of two, she couldn't just start buying herself toys. So she decided that, hey, Jim's into Conan, let's get him into this D&D thing, and he'll want these figures, and I get to paint them. So that's what happened. That worked very well for a little while for both of us, until she found out about the whole D&D is scary and satanic and will make you kill yourself kind of thing. And then she sat me down, made me watch Mazes and Monsters, the Tom Hanks movie, as if it was some sort of documentary. That was weird for a little bit, as I recall, but, you know, we were playing the game at her kitchen table, so it was pretty obvious what was going on and what wasn't going on in the game. So that was the beginning, and I guess it's been downhill ever since.
It's been a... it's been a spiral into Satan worship, magic, and yelling out Blackleaf in the night, I'm sure.
Absolutely. And you know, it's weird because at the time, you know, the 1983-1984, I didn't associate D&D with heavy metal at all. You know, later on, it was like 1992 when I became a metalhead, and... even then, I didn't associate the two at all. It wasn't until the early 2000s that for some reason it all clicked, that I started listening to the right kind of bands that were all about, you know, the Edgar Allan Poe and the Cthulhu and all this stuff, that And that's when it all sort of went, hey, wait a minute, you know, these things have something to do with each other. But sometimes I'm slow.
Excellent, excellent. Well, what came, what sort of got you guys into forming a company for that, a company that also has a game with its namesake, Lamentations of the Flame Princess?
Well, I had started a metal zine in 1998 with the name Lamentations of the Flame Princess. I was into bands like My Dying Bride and Opeth and, you know, really floofy, flowery, bands like that. And I, you know, wanted a title that kind of fit with that and not with brutal death metal or something like that. So that's where the name, that's why I decided to use that name. And, you know, I had wanted to get into RPG publishing forever because when you play these games, they're creative and you make stuff. And, you know, other people have published books and I've got ideas. I want to get that out there. So, you know, even in the 80s, I was, you know, had these little notebooks with these modules. I'd come up with crappy little covers and, you know, dungeons, and I'm going to make an official module. And it wasn't until the late 2000s that stuff actually happened, that I got my crap together and could actually do something and had the knowledge and the organization and the willpower to actually get something done. And once I did get to that point, I decided, you know, I've been using this Lamentations of the Flame Princess name for 10 years. It's pretty evocative. It fits this fantasy thing. So I'm just going to keep it. And, you know, it was after that, you know, Zach came to me with a book idea, and I was like, that's awesome. Let's go with it. You know, welcome to the team.
Oh, cool. And Zach, how did you get involved?
Yeah, I had this blog for a while. I still have it, Playing D&D with Porn Stars, which was just about our game. And then somebody put us on TV. So for a while, we had a show on a video game website called I Hit It With My Axe, which was just basically a documentary of our game. And during and after Axe, people kept asking me if they could use material from our game or for their game and stuff like that. And I kept saying, well, I'm not a game publisher. I have a day job. You know, I do other things. And I didn't really want someone to take it and change it around and put our logo on it or something. But I knew that I had seen some stuff that James had made, especially this module Death Frost Doom. And James in general just seemed like a nice guy. And he was also one person. And when you're dealing with a company, it's nice to deal with, you know, a human being, and you kind of know who they are and what they want. And so I was thinking, you know, I could just put together notes from our game and things like that that people have been asking for and just do it myself and then give it to James, because he seemed like it seemed like the path of least resistance. Mm-hmm. And also he seemed like he had the same ethos about gaming material as I did. So, you know, we got together, and so far it's worked out.
Now, how did so I'm gathering from this is that the two of you knew each other before sort of cooperating on game design and forming this company type of thing?
Well, James, it's James's company. I just did one book for him. I did Vornheim, the Complete City Kit. I knew him from the blogs, though, because from the sort of the old school D&D blogs, which mm-hmm. are full of people complaining about each other all the time. And the people that were getting complained about the most were me and James. And they would usually complain about not the things that we did wrong, but the very things that seemed most interesting. You know, like they would complain that James was like a metalhead, that he made D&D games that were, you know, scary and gratuitously gross. And they complained that I don't know, I feel like everything I like about myself, they complained about. And so we kind of were like, oh, you're that guy everyone's complaining about. And he was like, oh, you're that guy everyone's complaining about. So, you know, we formed an opposition, as all things, you know, as many people do.
Very nice. Well, let me go ahead and start off with a few questions that I have for you guys that was brought to my attention. What is the Old School Renaissance and the Old School Renaissance Group?
Well, it's not really like a formal.
Zach, you
want
to do this one, or should I?
I feel like I'll start, and you can listen, and then add anything if I leave anything out. But I feel like I'm sort of part of the Old School Renaissance. I say because they're the only D&D people that would have me. Mm-hmm. You know, I wrote this blog and I would talk about how, you know, I'm going to get rid of this rule and I'm going to get rid of that rule. I'm going to hack this rule and this rule is too complicated and bards are boring, and basically just completely overhauled the game to fit the players that I was playing with. And a lot of people flip out about that and a lot of people don't. And the people who don't are kind of all called old school Renaissance or old school D&Ders. And I don't know whether that's a really good label, but I guess the idea is that back in the day, people didn't feel very proprietorial about Orcus or Demogorgon or about once-a-day powers. So they just kind of changed the game around to fit how their group worked. And so that's sort of the ethos of most of the people that are associated with the Old School.
Now,
yeah, I just, let me throw in my two cents on the subject just so I can cause some trouble here. But I see the Old School Renaissance, it's I don't know, it's kind of like a power thing. You know, I enjoyed the Old School D&D. It's what I got started with. And as the game changed over the years, I didn't feel connected to the game so much as the editions progressed. And, you know, and I kind of dropped out of the game and largely gaming altogether in the late 90s. And in the early 2000s, when I came back and I found out that there were web communities, you know, dedicated to the old D&D, I was amazed. It, as I said, I'm kind of slow sometimes, but it never occurred to me that I could just go back to the old editions. I didn't have to give up D&D because I didn't like the version that was on the, you know, in the stores currently. And that was completely mind-blowing to me. And, you know, going through the 2000s or the early 2000s, you know, as part of this, you know, out-of-date little tiny minority of gamers, it was weird, because in the 80s, you know, you're playing D&D, you're part of this huge thing, there are millions of players, and now that same game, the players are like reduced to this tiny little sliver off in the corner. You know, the rest of the internet, the rest of the gaming community wants you to shut up and be a dinosaur in the corner. And when somebody figured out you could use the open game license to recreate, you know, the rules of old D&D and get that back out there in print, that you can, you know, legally, you know, print, you know, new adventures and new supplements, I think that was very empowering for a lot of people. And that caught on, and we didn't have to be dinosaurs. We didn't have to be in the corner. We could, you know, stand up and be at the table and say, you know, here we are, deal with us, and look how awesome all of this is. And to me, that's the old school Renaissance. Mm-hmm. That sense of, you know, we're not going to be in the corner anymore.
Now, some real quick question here. This is actually a question posed by one of our forum members. I let them know that we were going to be chatting, and they had a couple questions for you guys. They say, Rolling 20s asks, what are your thoughts in general as to the state of the old school Renaissance?
I think the old school
James,
Renaissance,
you wanna go first?
Right now is... I'll go first. I think it's going great. The one thing I'm concerned about is the main thing that makes it great. There are a lot of games with not a lot of differences, just minor differences. There are a lot of people that are throwing their hat into the ring that, you know, objectively, maybe you think, well, maybe, you know, maybe we would be a, you know, more solid, more powerful force with maybe less of this and more cooperation around fewer points. But that defeats the purpose. I mean, the whole old school Renaissance, the message is, you know, the game is ours. The game is yours. Do whatever you want with it. So then to sit back after the fact and say, well, you know, maybe we don't need 15 games, you know, that completely defeats the spirit of the whole thing. You know, the more the merrier, the ones that are interesting, the ones that appeal to a lot of people, they'll survive, they'll thrive, and so, you know, no problem. And, you know, all the time, you know, there's always somebody that's releasing something that gets more attention and, you know, in the greater gaming community, there's always somebody doing something that no one ever thought of before, you know, so creatively, the good stuff still coming out. As far as, you know, promotion and visibility, there are people that are continuing to push it. It's, you know, just expanding more and more. So I really, you know, I think it's going great. You know, it's, you know, I put the start of the old school Renaissance in 2006 with the release of Osric, and I think it's just gotten bigger and better from there.
Zach, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would just say mostly, like, for me, most of it has to do with people just feeling like they can come up with new tools for running games and they can just put them up for free online or, you know, get together with a bunch of people and publish it. And it doesn't have to be the only thing that anyone ever plays. It just has to be helpful to somebody, and then it's worth putting out. And a lot of people are doing that. And there are a lot of different tools going up really fast. And whenever I ask around about something, there's something like it coming around. So I'm pretty positive on it. It seems like there's a lot of things that inspire a lot of different people in a lot of different directions, which is really all you can ask for.
All right, cool. I have one last question about the old school Renaissance, also from Rolling 20s. Have you seen a rise in the popularity of your products due to the old school Renaissance at all?
I would say that the reason my products have any popularity at all is because of the, you know, of the work done in the people in the old school Renaissance before I started publishing. I'm putting in the work, I think, to expand my own audience and not just leech off of what other people have done. But I think my ability to, you know, sit at the table to begin with is because other people, you know, put in that work first. So I'd say my entire success, whatever success I have, is because there is an old school Renaissance already there.
Excellent. Well, that's the appetizer. Now let's go ahead and get into the meat of this. What is, for our intrepid listeners, what exactly is the Lamentations of the Flame Princess game that you guys put out?
Okay, well, the game is mine. Vornheim is Zach's. So let's keep that clear, so we're not stepping on each other's toes there. But Lamentations of the Flame Princess, weird fantasy role-playing, is the idea is taking the skeleton and the commonly known rules that everybody knows. You know, everybody knows how to play. Everybody knows the procedures. My idea was to take that and just twist it to the way that I like to play, because I had previously released a series of adventures, Death, Frost, Doom, No Dignity in Death, that people said that this feels different, this is fresh, this isn't, you know, D&D how it's always been played and, you know, the atmosphere that it's had for 30, 35 years. And I thought, as a publisher, because I really love putting out books. I love writing stuff, love seeing my name in print. It's this, you know, it's something that really gives me a rush. And I thought, to move forward doing that, I really need my own game. I need my own brand. And once I decided to do that, it it really, the only thing to do was to highlight the differences between my style and what's already there, what's already, you know, commonly known. Mm-hmm. So I decided to put this weird horror twist with this, you know, little feeling of heavy metal into it to you know, get away from the commonly assumed heroic D&D where, you know, the whole thing is you become these big bad heroes and you go and you defeat the bad guy and collect his treasure. I dialed that back a little bit. You're still special. You're still adventuring types. You still have magic. You can still become this great fighter, but you just turn the dial down a bit. It's got the horror atmosphere. You're not the, you know, baddest ass on the block. You're dealing with truly the unknown, with truly these monsters that are going to eat you up. Mm-hmm. And how do you deal with that? I mean, do you become this, you know, just sneak thief that just, you know, tries to skulk in the shadows and get what you can and run away? Or do you step up and try to fight these things? I mean, that's all possible in the game, but if you approach it as more of a horror game, as more of something unbalancing rather than, you know, we're going on an adventure, we're going to defeat the monsters and collect the treasure, I do think that changes the tone and the atmosphere completely.
Mm-hmm. And what is the Grindhouse edition? I know that's the version you've put out. It's obviously a new printing of the game. But what is it? Yes. What do you mean by the Grindhouse edition?
Okay, well, after the deluxe edition sold out, that was the first printing of the game last year, I decided that I wanted to do something more exciting than a straight reprint. And I needed an angle. Because looking back now, the deluxe edition, it's not a very exciting name. And I didn't want to just put something out that was, you know, the revised edition, second mm-hmm. edition. That's boring. So I needed a hook. And it was, I think around October last year when I started finalizing this sort of thing. And in Finland, there's something called the Night Visions Festival, mm-hmm. which is really all about, you know, grindhouse type movies, you know, the 70s kind of movies that you watch and go, ooh, I feel kind of dirty after watching that. You know, I like these kind of movies, the old Hammer horror movies, Dario Argento, you know, that kind of thing, you know, those old Italian cannibal movies. So I thought that would be a great hook because that would get across, you know, by calling it the Grindhouse Edition and filling it with grindhouse kind of imagery, I think that will get across the atmosphere of the game more than me just going, blah, 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 this game is about blah, blah, blah. You can just page through and you see it. So I just decided to go for it. I mean, what do I have to lose, really? So I thought, okay, let's go for this. Let's be gross. Let's be a little bit disgusting. And there it is.
All right, cool. Now, this is a question for Zach. You're obviously the guy who came up with Vornheim.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about what Vornheim is, how it relates to Lamentations of the Flame Princess, and sort of what was the synthesis of getting that book out there?
Well, basically, James is really... It's not very system-specific. Mm-hmm. Vornheim pretty much fits any D&D or D&D variant, and we included notes to get it so that any kind of popular version of D&D it will fit with. And it also fits with Lamentations, but it was really just the aesthetic that goes together. But Vornheim is a toolkit for running cities, like fantastic cities in any sort of medieval setting. And my idea with Vornheim was basically to take everything that I used when I was improvising a city during a game, all the tables and charts and all the house rules, and put them together in one place. And also to look at other... basically, you know how if you get a city supplement like Tolis or something, or Forgotten Realms, you go through with a highlighter and you highlight 3 pages out of 30, and then the rest is sort of background noise. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to create a city supplement that was all signal and no noise. That was all tools to run the game, and if there needed to be background, it would just be communicated in a sentence or two the way it was, like, you know, the way they do it in a novel or something. You know, a Fafford and Grey Mouser story doesn't start with the history of Lankmar. It starts with a couple sentences that establish the mood and the tone, and then it moves on to what's going on. So I basically wanted to make a really efficient book for running cities, like a 64-page GM screen, essentially.
Sure.
So that you could just have it, and it wouldn't get in the way to have this one more book. It would actually help.
Cool. Now, the I think the thing that really stood out for me when I saw the book was your method of using the book itself, and not just tables and charts and that sort of thing, but actually the cover of the book is itself a tool you can use. How did you come up with that that idea? I mean, that seems like a very interesting way of doing that sort of thing.
Well, I figured, like, for most of these things, my general thought is, if I have a new tool for running a game, I don't need to put it in a book and charge money for it. Mm-hmm. So if I was going to go through all the trouble of making a book, I wanted to make the fact that it was a book helpful to the DM. Mm-hmm. So books have hardcovers, or at least, you know, James wanted a hardcover, so I figured I'll use these hardcovers as a tool. So the front and the back of the book are their charts that you drop the dice directly on.
Right.
And so you can drop a D4 on the cover, and it will generate about 200 some... It'll choose among, like, 200-odd possibilities for, like, 12 different things. Like, you can generate a basic thief, a basic monster, a basic wizard, the duration, damage, and area of effect of a spell. Things that come up over and over. Guards, like when somebody says guards, how many guards, what level, what's their armor class? So if you had written those all out as regular tables, you would have needed more than a D100 table, and you would have needed 12 of them. But by using this sort of graphic drop-on thing, you can get several results just using a simple... by dropping the die, looking at the die, and seeing where it landed on the book. And then in general with the book, everything that a book has, I tried to figure out a way to make that more helpful in the game. Like, mm-hmm. if we're going to have a map and going to have a key, let's have the map and the key facing each other on the same page. Things like that. So also there's a dust cover. The back of the dust cover is a map.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I was just thinking, I want to make a book not that other people will want, but the book that I would want. And the book that I want when I'm playing a game is a book that has nothing except useful stuff, you know? So that's kind of how I came up with that.
Yeah, it's definitely not something I've seen before, and it's a very efficient way of using not only stuff that's in the book, but the book itself. It was very, very unique.
Thanks.
Now, back over to James, and this sort of goes also over to you, Zach, but how do you guys compare both Lamentations and Vornheim to really what's come before? I mean, you guys are well-rooted in old-school gaming, but what is how do you compare it to those old-school games and to, obviously, some people are growing up now who have only played D&D 3rd Edition or only played 4th Edition, that sort of thing. How do you compare it to those?
James, can I do this one?
Sure, yeah.
Okay. For me, I would say, as it compares to the old games, they're both actually really different in a way. I think that the old games were very open because they sort of assumed certain play styles, but we don't even know what those assumptions were, a lot of us. You can, if you read carefully the original Dungeons & Dragons books, you still won't know what's going on unless you have a little bit of a background in the wargaming that was already happening then. And so, basically, just as all of philosophy is people trying to figure out what Plato was talking about, a lot of role-playing game design after that was people trying to figure out what Gary was talking about in those early books. So, when James made his game, he was very, very specific about what he thought D&D was about or what he wanted it to be about. And he's very specific about how the rules support a certain play style that's the one that he wants to do. So he wants a play style where the characters are relatively weak, the world is relatively exotic and scary and creative, and they're exploring that world. So he's tuned things that way. When I was creating Vornheim, I was very explicitly interested in not creating a setting book, which there are millions of on the market ever since early D&D, but creating a toolkit that is the kind of thing that maybe those people who invented Forgotten Realms or Tolis used when they were inventing their city. In other words, it's not an after-the-fact roundup of everything someone made up for their campaign. It's the toolkit that you would use to generate it in the first place. So I think in both cases, we're both sort of... they're not so much about recreating an old thing as simply we look at D&D, we figure out how we want to play, and then created tools very specifically designed to make that kind of playing easy. So what James wanted was a book about weird, horrific exploration, or a game about that, and I wanted a book that would let me not prep at all when my players were like, we don't feel like going into the dungeon tonight, we're going to go shopping. And I can open up the book and I can get them through a session, and the session is interesting without me having to do a lot of work in advance.
Yeah, that sums it up pretty well for me. Thank you, Zach.
All right, now, real quick question. This goes more towards James. Does Lamentations of the Flame Princess really have a default setting? If so, could you sort of give us a rundown of that? Also, how would someone sort of use aspects of Lamentations, be able to use aspects of Lamentations for like a different game or campaign setting?
I don't think... Well, my game does not have an explicit included with the game setting. The referee book, a lot of it is advice on how to create your own setting. Because to me, that's always been the most fun part of running games. That's, as the game master, referee, whatever you want to call it, that's it. That's the whole thing. Creating a world and creating situations and creating dangerous locations, then dumping some players in to ruin it all and see what happens. That's the game to me. So for me to sit there and say, okay, and this is going to be a setting, and here's what this country's like, and that's King blah blah, and this, to me, that's something that should be an adventure. That shouldn't... You know, the whole idea of a setting that you publish for other people, that's never ended well for me, because you end up worrying about, well, what if I get a detail wrong, or then I'm not really playing the setting, and then if you tell the players we're doing the Forgotten Realms, we're going to play in the Forgotten Realms, and that player has 10 times the Forgotten Realms knowledge that I do, it's not going to run right, because I could say that, no, we're going by what I say and not the books. Then what's the point of telling this player we're playing in the Forgotten Realms, and he gets excited because he loves the Forgotten Realms? And that's just a mess. That takes away from the game at the table when you're arguing about setting details. So if you give a game master the tools to create his own setting and advice and basically permission, you know, that creates something that's at the table, that's specific to that group, and you don't have that kind of arguing. That said, the atmosphere I try to push in the artwork and, you know, with some of the rules, it's more of a late Renaissance, early modern setting rather than the medieval setting that lots of fantasy role-playing games want to default to. To me, the costumes just look cooler, you know, as far as the fashion, the armor, weapons. The way that people usually play their campaigns with, you know, a free, you know, merchant class and these roving bands of armed men going from town to town. And to me, that's not very medieval, where people were bonded to the land and, you know, the power structures were very strict. So to say medieval with the way that most people play role-playing games, it usually you know, I'm a history nerd. I read history books. I've got shelves of them. I've got more history books than I think fiction books. You know, I don't read a lot of fantasy and devour a lot of fantasy novels. I read history books. So that is one of those things that probably doesn't matter to anyone else, but it matters to me. So I'm thinking, okay, just advance the timeline up a bit, and nothing changes about your game except fashion.
Now, on the other end of this, Zach, talking about Vornheim, you sort of touched a bit on the generic aspects of what the book is, but it does say on it that it is for that it's a Lamentations of the Flame Princess release, that sort of thing. How would someone go about using Vornheim for Lamentations of the Flame Princess?
Well, it's actually just, it's a little confusing because sure. James's game and his publishing company have the same name.
Right.
But essentially, you know, the Lamentations has armor class, it has hit points, it mm-hmm. has, you know, 3 to 18 stats. It has all, it's very similar to Retro Clones, although it has been tweaked in very specific ways to make mm-hmm. it pointed towards a more horrific atmosphere. So it's I just wrote it for generic D&D, which wasn't that hard, because for me, that book is mostly, like, I invented a monster called a blue tiger, and it's just a blue tiger, and it has two souls, so you have to cast a spell on it twice, and if you have a dream about a blue tiger, you'll be attacked by one the next day. None of those things are mechanics dependent, mm-hmm. you know? The hit points in the armor class and the damage attack are afterthoughts, but they're in there. So, and I've even got a 4E conversion in the back for it, you know, if you need, you know, help making all those monsters fit the most official version of the game. Mm-hmm. But basically, 90% of what's in that book, I've seen people are telling me they're using it for RuneQuest, somebody is using it they're using it for a Shadowrun setting. I mean, it's mostly about, who's this NPC? What's this building? You know, what's in this guy's pockets? Things like that. It's not for mechanical. It's not adding mechanical complexity to your game. It's just allowing you to help you improvise what's going on in the game.
All right, cool. Now, this sort of goes to both of you, but what kind of non-RPG sources were inspirations for both Vornheim and Lamentations of the Flame Princess? James, you mentioned grindhouse films and history books sort of being a major influence in the way that you game and the way that you shaped Lamentations. What other sources were out there that gave you guys some inspiration?
I think we're both really interested in pulp material, like the 60s and earlier fantasy novels and stories by people like Jack Vance. A lot of the people that are actually listed in the Appendix N of the original Dungeons & Dragons, the literary sources. Mm-hmm. I was also interested, if you look at Warhammer... and Warhammer 40K by Games Workshop, and you look at the people who influenced them, one of their big influences was a writer named M. John Harrison, who was in turn influenced by Michael Moorcock. But those guys wrote about cities, about sort of a more, like, sort of sophisticated cultures, despite having, you know, a sort of fantasy level of technology. That was a big influence on Vornheim. Also, you know, things like Edgar Allan Poe's The Mask of the Red Death, things like that. Just stories, like, not... I guess the biggest thing is it wasn't that influenced by recent RPG books. That's the biggest influence, I guess, is an anti-influence.
Yeah.
Now, James, you mentioned about, you know, talked a bit about the Lamentations of the Flame Princess, the system, and sort of the core of the book. As I understand it, there's no, like, established monsters out of the box. So, like, there's no, so our readers or listeners can understand, there's no, like, monster manual for this. What was the reasoning behind that?
Reasoning behind that is because once you define a monster with stats, it's mm-hmm. no longer special and it's no longer scary.
Right.
You know, there are there are stats for two monsters given in the book as an example. One is the vampire, because everyone knows what a vampire is, so I think that was helpful as an example of how to take something that everybody knows about, how to take something with all these weird ideas, you know, it can climb up walls and controls wolves and what the hell, and put it into game terms. So it's kind of a, you know, what everyone knows translated into the game, that's how that works. Mm-hmm. The other one is the monster that's, you know, part of the introductory adventure, so of course you have to stat that out and say this is how it works. And I think those work as functional examples, because the one thing that I really don't like about classic D&D is the fact that the standard monsters, the classics, you when you're playing D&D, I feel pressured to use the classics. For example, the troll. How can you avoid using a troll if you're playing D&D? But the problem is, as soon as, no matter how you try to disguise it, you don't call it a troll, you just describe it, all the players at the table go, oh, that's a troll, break out the torches, their vulnerability is fire.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, that's not... You know, that's fun for a little bit, but when you bring out a parade of monsters and the players all know about them, that's not so much fun. And what do you do about that? I don't want to make the players play dumb. Well, Joe, I know you've been playing for 30 years, but your character is, you know, second level and has never seen a troll. You wouldn't know to break out the fire. So are you going to make the guy play like crap for 10 minutes, you know, just so he can pretend that he doesn't know what's going on? I hate that. So... one thing that I did with my game to really increase the uneasiness, to, you know, increase unpredictability, is leave out the standard bestiary. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's, you know, what is it, 5-6 pages on how to make monsters. I mean, I'm not completely silent on the monster issue, but I encourage people to, you know, customize their monsters for their group, for the adventure, for their campaign. You know, that don't get lazy and go to the book and just decide, oh, I'm going to use this one. You know, if there's a monster in your game, that should be special. It shouldn't be a safari where you're going from location to location looking at, oh, look at that weird, fearsome creature, let's kill it. Ooh, look at that weird, fearsome creature, let's kill it. I don't like that atmosphere. I don't want to promote that atmosphere in my work. So I just say, you know, don't use standard monsters. Make them weird, make them unique, and think about how you use them.
That's cool. I've got two more questions from one of our forum, one of our listeners, actually. Son of Hideous Heart asks you, both of you guys, actually, we'll go ahead and put this out to both Zach and James. Do you guys prefer the old-style games to the more modern ones in general? If so, why?
Well, for me, I didn't make so much an explicit, like, I prefer the old games as much as, I didn't play at all for many years, and when I came back, the only people that I played with were adults, and they hadn't played in a long time. And so when they were saying, let's play D&D, they didn't have any reason to abandon the old rules. They liked them, and I'm a grown-up with two jobs, so I didn't really... You know, nobody saw a reason to learn a new system, and nobody saw a reason to abandon the old system. So it wasn't so much like an explicit choice at first. But then as I played, I was looking at a lot of the new games because people would send them to me. And some of the ideas are good, but in general, the ethos, I think, of the new games is it's on the character that you play. If you can imagine it, like, sort of comic books are more about the character. Like, Spider-Man comics are about Spider-Man. They're called Spider-Man. You know, the comic is called Spider-Man. The interesting thing in a Spider-Man comic is more Spider-Man than the world he inhabits. The world he inhabits is New York. And it's about, you know, his development, his changes, his powers, his abilities, and it's sort of player-centric in a sense. And I think, and video games are even more like that in a lot of ways. And I think the newer games kind of slide in that direction. They're very player-centric, and the player develops over time. Whereas in the old D&D, because there was the assumption that you might die at any minute, the emphasis was not on the character being interesting, but on the world being interesting and on exploring that world. Mm-hmm. And so even though I just sort of played the old games by default, as I got as I started playing them, I realized that I really liked that idea, that my players who were not, you know, they're not RPG people for the most part, could just show up and kind of play whatever and play however, and they could kind of be ordinary people, or they could be into their characters, like extremely into them, whatever they wanted, but the world was really rich and complex, and that was sort of, they were sort of investigating it and altering it and changing it, and they were growing by playing rather than by kind of making up little short stories about their characters, which a lot of them were not, they didn't start playing to do that in the first place. So it's sort of, it has to do with where the emphasis is. I think as the RPG audience has shrunk since the 80s, games have more and more emphasized, they're basically games for people who have been playing role-playing games for many years, or games for people who have played a lot of video games that are like role-playing games, such that if you pick up like a red, Green Ronin book right now, I cannot even imagine handing some of those rules over to my players. They'd vomit. Like, I can't even get half my players to read an email, much less, you know, how to make a character in DC Adventures. So the sort of rules light player but intensive world kind of assumptions about old D&D fit for me, and they fit my group.
James, what about you?
Yeah, I think I've fallen into the same thing, that newer versions of D&D, at least, they seem to me to be more about, you know, character builds and making the character unique and the character special. And to me, that creates all sorts of problems with my playstyle. You know, I used to be really big into the hero system. I used to be really big into GURPS. But those things are really front-loaded as far as time goes. The last time I tried to play the hero system, I think I turned away, you know, I turned off a half dozen people who wanted to play role-playing games, but the character creation procedure was more complicated than university math classes.
Yeah.
And that's only a slight exaggeration. You know, and they ran away
James
screaming.
Play with a lot
I probably
people
think the role-players are just... What was that, Zach?
We've both played with a lot of people who have never played before, and we do that regularly. Like, you run a lot of games
yeah.
with, you know, whoever answers your notice, and I play with almost all, I would say 75% of my players have never played one of these games before. So you can't give them a lot of the modern rules-heavy systems, and you can't give them a lot of the new rules-light but creativity-immediately-heavy systems, you know?
Yeah, and if you spend an hour, hour and a half making a character, you should have an expectation that that character is going to last longer than 15 minutes at the table. And I don't like guaranteeing that at my table. I mean, for example, right now I'm not running a game. I'm playing in someone else's game, and I think it was 10, 15 minutes into the first session, my character is the one that dies. I mean, just splat. And I was like, oh, crap. And so I just made another character, and I was, you know, right back in the action another 5-10 minutes. That's, you know, it's... The interesting thing should be the gameplay, not the preparation for gameplay. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, I like some new games. I like Dogs in the Vineyard, which is like 7 years old now, so it doesn't even count as new anymore. The last non-D&D or D&D-derived or D&D-influenced game that I played was Made, because it was after a convention. Everyone's like, oh, let's play something. And, oh, I got this Made game. Well, okay, fine. And it was really easy to set up and start playing, and there wasn't a mountain of bookkeeping. And, you know, it was fun. So I'm not against new games. I think I'm against games that, you know, have a lot of bookkeeping and things that... I'm against games that really turn your character into, I don't know, this special thing just by virtue of it having been created. To me, the character is a playing piece. It's the window through which you view the game world. And, you know, by play experience, I think that's how a character should be unique. That's how you remember a character. If you show up with your two pages of character background and here are my stats and special powers, I'm not interested. Not interested.
All right. Well, I have one last question from one of our listeners. He's curious as far as Lamentations of the Frame Princess and Vornheim are all pretty self-contained sets and books in and of themselves. Do you guys have any plans to expand on what you guys have put out for, like, any new takes on it, like sci-fi, modern, Western stuff? Because you mentioned Grindhouse, pulp stuff, and that's all sort of part of that genre.
Well, I'm running a hack...
Vornheim.
No, I'm running a hack Vornheim contest, and so the idea of the contest is hopefully I won't have to write anything new, because... people will write their own stuff and post it online. And so some of the ideas and the ways of getting results fast that I demonstrate or use in the book, other people will catch on and there'll be more of them. But if there's not enough, I may have to write something else. I'm trying to resist writing RPG books. But I'm like a DM, like everybody else. So I have a book full of notes. If that notebook gets to the size of a publishable thing and nobody is doing the things that I need as tools, then I might just call James up again and go, look, no one's publishing this book. I guess we'll have to do it. So that's me.
Yeah, and the things that I have planned for, you know, Lamentations... really aren't specifically expansions for this game.
Mm-hmm.
I think this game is, as you said, self-contained.
Right.
The things that are coming out later are either going to be adventures, which will most match the flavor of Lamentations, but the adventures can be used with all of the games that have a similar rules base. Then you've got Vornheim. That's something that I'm releasing, but you'll notice that the Lamentations logo is small on the bottom of the back cover. It's not specifically for Lamentations, and that's how the upcoming Carcosa book is going to be. That's how the upcoming Isle of the Unknown is going to be. Works perfectly well for my game, but it's not just specifically for my game. I don't want to create this supplement treadmill where people feel like they have to buy, you know, eventually 10 books in order to understand and really be part of my game. All you need is the box. These other things are optional extras. They're, you know, standalone, awesome things that could be used with my game or with whatever other game you'd like.
Cool. And Zach, you mentioned a contest, and so I'm going to use that sort of as a springboard real quick here. James was kind enough to give our listeners, if you listen to this episode, you'll be able to do this, a code to use in the online store at the Legends of the Flame Princess website at lotfp.com. The code that he gave me is Haven2011. And it gives you 20% off the order in the store once per customer, isn't that right?
Yes. And that should be in all caps.
All caps. So
Haven
2011, all caps. So that's a special treat for those listeners who are with us still. So I've just got some generic questions for you guys before I let you go. Zach, James, when was the last time you guys picked up and rolled some dice, and what was it for?
Last time I rolled any dice was last week, because my friend Darren has convinced me to play in a 4E game that he is running. And so I rolled myself a Warlord, 46 dropped the lowest, and I he's a hideously overpowered first level character, and I'm kind of elated and frightened at the prospect of playing. It will be my second time ever playing 4E, and I'm just going to imagine that I'm on Cartoon Network and it's like an anime, and I think I'll be fine.
Cool. What about you, James?
We had the game last Sunday. As I said, I'm a player in somebody else's game right now, so that's fun to leave the creative heavy lifting to someone else for a little while and just be the nasty witch hunter that wants to burn all the evil witches. And we assaulted the Baron's Keep, and, you know, death and fun were had by all.
Now, one thing that the Gamer's Haven is all about is sort of spreading the love of the tabletop hobby, and you guys definitely are very much a supporters of that, I can tell. What is it about this hobby, this tabletop hobby, that keeps you guys coming back to the table? What is it that you love about it?
What I like is that it's a way that you can kind of involve your friends in anything that you want to talk about or deal with, or anything that they want to talk about. All the ideas that you think are cool, or pictures that you think are cool, or things about history that you think are cool, or things about ways to build medieval fortifications that you think are cool, or old fairy tales that you think are cool, or just tactics and like cute problem-solving ideas that you think are cool. You can kind of bring them, and in a way, when you're DMing or playing, you're kind of talking about them. And then on the other hand, both for the players and for me, it's like a mental exercise. It's like a chess game. I mean, I like things to be hard. I prefer it when the game is, you know, when the challenges are, you know, such that it's not set up like I'm automatically going to win. And I like chess, and I like, you know, puzzles and things like that. So I like having a one hit point wizard and trying to figure out, well, how am I going to kill this dragon anyway? You know, it's a creative problem solving thing. And I live in LA, and mostly what people talk about is reality TV and their cars. So it's kind of a welcome antidote to have to think.
James?
Yeah, I like that chess talk, but to me it's all about what if, and setting the table with a what if, and seeing how it could play out. For example, the old Conan story, Red Nails. What if it wasn't Conan in this story? What if it's some other Joe Blow? What happens? You know, does the plot go the same way? Do they win? Do they escape? Do they, you know, team up with the other side in the conflict? And I think that the tabletop gaming hobby, you know, the traditional role-playing games, is the best way to explore that kind of thing. You have an idea, this spontaneous idea, you see a movie, you read a story, whatever, you can show up the next week and set the table to say, what if it, you know, what if we had this story, but with this different setup? You know, it's, I guess, the fun of the old what if Marvel comics, you know, what if Captain America met Conan the Barbarian? You know, that kind of controlled anarchy, I guess.
Actually, incidentally, Red Nails is probably my favorite Conan story, so good one there. All right. Now, I want to thank you guys for taking the time out of your schedules, and of course, James, for getting yourself up at 4 o'clock in the morning to talk to me. It has been a...
No problem. Thank you.
It has been a pleasure to talk to both of you guys, and I want to thank you guys for being on the show.
Well, thanks, Ethan.
You've been listening to the Gamer's Haven Podcast. Subscribe to the show by visiting our website at gamershavenpodcast.com, where you can also discuss all things gaming in our forum,
drop us an email, or just peruse our episode archives. You can also call us toll-free and leave a message to be played on the show by dialing 1-877-416-1270. That's toll-free, 877-416-1270. On our website, you'll also find our actual play podcasts chronicling our misadventures through all things role-playing. Enjoy what you hear? Why not support the Gamers Haven by purchasing Gamers Haven merchandise, visiting our affiliates, or just by clicking on our donate button? The Gamers Haven podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial, Share Alike 3.0 United States license, some rights reserved. Some music in this podcast is used with permission of Joe Hero Band at joehero.com. This is a Thousand Monkeys production.
This concludes the broadcast from World Control.